Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. Welcome to The Original Guide to Men's Health, a podcast designed for men of all ages to learn about and access good health. This guide shares knowledge on how to be and stay healthy, maintenance and prevention strategies, along with reviews of conditions and issues affecting wellness are explored. Please join me, your host, Dr. Richard Pellman, as I interview renowned experts who will provide you with timely, relevant, and vital information so that you can embark on a journey towards better health. For more information from this podcast, including take-home points and resource links, we invite you to visit our website, theoriginalguidetomenshealth.org. You can also find us on social media. We invite you to follow us there and share episodes on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. In this episode of The Original Guide to Men's Health, we will be exploring good health and driver safety. Perhaps we wonder why it's important to have good health. Well, some of the reasons are obvious, but we'll be exploring the necessity of maintaining your health to be a good driver. I know most of us think we are the next Jackie Stewart or Emma Fittipaldi or Richard Petty or Dale Earnhardt of the world, but there's always something to learn. Ask the best race car drivers and they will tell you they're constantly learning and assessing. So joining us today, we are very fortunate to have a guest who is a very experienced author and expert in driver safety. Mi-A Leip is a Seattle-based writer, editor, graphic designer who lives another life as a citizen traffic safety advocate. In 2011, she founded a blog called Driving in the Real World and is the author of a very popular monthly column on traffic safety and ADAS technology for Roundel, the national magazine of the BMW Car Club of America. Along with fellow citizen advocate Mark Butcher, she has worked extensively with Washington state government agencies to strengthen their driver training, testing, instructor curricula, and licensing standards. In 2016, she and Mark organized and led a fact-finding trip to the UK by Washington state government officials and driving school owners to explore that country's traffic safety ecosystem, long considered one of the best in the world. In 2017, she and Mark were publicly recognized by the NHTSA at the Lifesavers Conference for this work. She is currently part of a government group that shapes strategy and policy around autonomous vehicle testing and implementation in Washington State, and she writes and consults about road safety for organizations both in America and internationally. So welcome, Mi-A, and I just want to add one thing. In addition to all your driving experience and driver's safety knowledge, you were also the author of Bounty from the Box, the CSA Farm Cookbook. So I just want people to know that you have an extremely varied expertise. If you want to talk a moment about the cookbook, then we can go into motor vehicle safety and driver safety.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show. And I'm just delighted to be here. And I wasn't expecting the mention of the cookbook, but yes, I have a few multiple lives, and one of them is that I am the author of a cookbook that if you subscribe to a local organic farm, or if you shop at a farmer's market, or just do regular grocery shopping, I wrote a cookbook about how to cook with fruits and vegetables and kind of everything about that. So it's a reference encyclopedia and meant to be a great workhorse and a companion in the kitchen.
You know, looking at health and its tie-in to driver safety and driving. And of course, people figure, well, yeah, you have to have certain issues that work well in your body in order not to be an impaired driver. But, you know, if we take a look at this, we not only have to talk about eyesight, but people consider night vision, hearing, mobility, physical restrictions, mental and emotional health, And of course, fatigue and stress levels all play into this. So you have some interesting background knowledge and some data, particularly from a fighter jet pilot regarding vision issues. So go a little bit into health and driving for us, and we'll cover that, and then we'll move on to some other aspects of driver safety.
I think a lot of people think that driving is, you know, it's sort of an everyday kind of a relatively simple skill because we do it all the time and usually without incident. But, you know, we often in American society, especially, we tend to kind of separate health and everyday function a bit for some of us. And driving is kind of one of those under the radar activities where, you know, if your body is functioning better, it definitely is going to improve the performance that you have when you're doing this, you know, very much potentially dangerous activity. So obviously the eyesight, hearing, mobility, the physical restrictions, especially your mental health, I think that actually really affects driving a lot more than many of us might consider, and certainly fatigue and stress. And so, you know, some years ago, I was doing some driver training research. I came across a really interesting PDF article by a fellow. His name is John Sullivan, and he was a former Royal Air Force pilot. So this is for the UK. And he actually wrote about a 15-page article about there are certain vision tactics that fighter jet pilots are taught. And the thing that is behind this is that a lot of people think that, you know, pilots doing fighter jets, they have all this fancy instrumentation and all of that. And they do, they have amazing technology, but a surprising amount of actually flying and maneuvering a fighter jet is actually vision. And the thing that they're taught about how to overcome certain deficiencies that we humans have in our vision. And then those came about kind of from an evolutionary or biological standpoint. So the more that I read about this article, the more it was just stunning to me. It's suddenly realizing all the different ways that we naturally have deficiencies in our vision, and most of us don't know about them. Or we don't know how our eyes and brains work together, or they sometimes don't. The more that I read about that, the more I realized, like, oh my goodness, now that suddenly explains a lot of things, like why we miss seeing things, why we thought things were there when they actually were not, and all kinds of, you know, issues on the road. So going into them, I'm just going to give a brief overview of just some of the most major ones. But one of them is that, let's say that you're about to make a turn out of a parking garage, or you're just making a turn out of your driveway. So you take a quick look. We usually look left if we're backing out. Sometimes if we're going forward, we look left. And then we make a quick right glance. And then we look back left again one more time. But, you know, and then we think we're good. We don't see anything. And then we start to pull out, and all of a sudden there's somebody there. It could be a car, could be a bicyclist or a motorcyclist. And then we think, well, what in the heck? I just did look and I didn't see that person or vehicle coming. Well, it turns out that one of the things that may have been at play there is that we have gaps in our vision that are called saccades. So it's S-A-C-C-A-D-E. And what happens is that if our head is moving, we actually cannot register what we're seeing while the head is moving. So in other words, if you are making a turn, what you need to do is to keep your head momentarily still. So when you make that look to the left or the right or the center, that you should keep your head momentarily still. And it only needs to be for a second or a fraction of a second. But the idea is that you need to have your head absolutely still for just a moment, and then make sure that you look in a dedicated way, meaning that you're actually mentally focused on that look, because then that's the moment at which your head stops moving and then your brain can register what's in the scene. You do that left, you do that center, you also do that right. When you go back to look at the left again, you keep your head momentarily still again. And then the second thing is that when you're making a turn, you may want to just do a creep and peep. So you do the thing that I said before of looking and keeping your head still for a moment. But then instead of just shooting out into traffic, you may want to just creep and peep, meaning that you just creep forward a little bit and you look again in the same way that I mentioned. And what that does is the fact you've changed your position means it gives you a second chance to see whatever may be coming that you didn't see before because they were hidden in the windshield pillar or by your mirror or something else. And so that's a really good way to sort of double check and ensure the safety of you and whoever may be coming. Another thing that kind of works against us with the saccades is that our brains, we tend not to see what we don't expect to see. So for instance, let's say that you are turning out of your driveway or a parking space and you have done this hundreds or maybe thousands of times before. So every other time before, there's been nobody there coming down the sidewalk or down the road. And so you just think that at the 1,000th time that you do this, that the road's going to be all clear. So maybe you do look, but you don't see anybody there. And then lo and behold, there is somebody and you are caught by surprise. That's really scary. And that can be, you know, obviously lethal for other people. So why did that happen? It's because your brain kind of filled in with what it expected to see. And so you might have been literally looking at something, but your brain just simply didn't register it because that was always how that picture was. So we're kind of hit with a double whammy there when it comes to that. So those are really easy ways that we just miss seeing, especially things that are smaller, like motorcycles or a child, pedestrian, because they have a slimmer profile. So we're not as likely to see them in the first place.
And, you know, I think the other aspect of that is an example. I was in a fairly low car coming out of a driveway, and there was an SUV parked on the street. And as I was backing out, I couldn't see anything past the SUV that was on the right side. And a truck coming up, you know, I was backing slowly because I knew I couldn't see. And the truck was zooming up and he stops as I'm backing out. And he gives me, you know, you need to be looking. And I'm looking. I'm like, buddy, you got to be aware. I can't see anything behind that. And a lot of people make that error, particularly in major boulevards where there's perhaps cars parked and people, pedestrians step out from those parked cars where the driver coming down boulevard can't see those people. And if people are looking at their device and not paying attention, either way, there's going to be a problem. But keep going.
I know exactly what you mean about the SUV. That's one thing. One of the many things I don't like about SUVs is that they do block the vision for, you know, both the people who are coming and the people who are trying to see around them. And particularly if an SUV shoots across a cross line. And so then you feel like you got to creep out even further, but that's not good either. But getting back to some of these fighter pilot techniques. So another thing is that fighter jet pilots are taught about something called windscreen zoning. So this is really interesting. And I bet once I describe it, your readers will, your listeners will, you know, that they'll identify with this. But there's a thin area of space that surrounds anything that is framed. So if you think about looking out your windshield, there's an area kind of running all the way around the perimeter of the windshield, especially on the inner part. So it could be, I don't know, like 10%, 15% of that area inside the edges. You are not likely to see things as much in that perimeter as you would be, say, if you look right out directly in front of your windshield or just above and below that center part. So think about that there's a whole area that could be as much as 20% of your windshield that you're not seeing right around at the edge. You multiply that by the side windows. So let's say the area right by your exterior mirrors, there where there's the A pillar. The A pillar is the part that is the slanted pillar that holds the windshield in place. So, and then there's the mirror and then any inner space just inside your windows, your side windows. So assuming that we might not really pay attention to what's around those mirrors or those side window windscreen zoning areas, it's possible that you could be losing up to about 30 or 40% of that available window space, that you're literally not seeing or not paying enough attention to that space. It's also compounded by the fact that we have a rearview mirror, usually that is coming down in our windshield, and we tend to sort of overlook that area because, again, our eyes register that as part of a windscreen. It's something that has space kind of framed around it. A lot of the newer vehicles have pretty steeply raked windshields. We don't have the greenhouse space that we used to have in older cars where things are more upright and boxy. So by the time you factor in the space around that rearview mirror that you're not seeing with where the top of the dashboard may be coming for your line of sight, there's a whole column there kind of in the middle where things can easily get lost, and we just assume that we are seeing everything out of our windows when we're not.
So recommendations for easing that problem?
Well, I mean, one recommendation is just to look, you know, as I said, you already now know about saccades, about those gaps. So I think part of it is that just because we look in a place, it doesn't mean we see something, right? And those windscreen zoning areas, especially by your right side mirror in the A pillar on the right side of your car, that's especially critical. Because if you're stopped in front of a crosswalk and pedestrians are starting to walk, that's kind of like a triple jeopardy threat there, because you got the windscreen zoning and the saccades, and you've got active activity, shall we say, that is walking right in front of you, and it's incredibly easy to miss that. So another thing I might recommend is that never hang anything off your rearview mirror. You know, we see a lot of people with like little doodads and air freshener tags and masks, especially coming out of COVID. So there's all kinds of things that they dangle in front, but that's dangerous because those things move. They not only block, but they also move. And so humans, we excel in our peripheral vision and detecting movement. So we may very well interpret the movement of that little dangling object as, you know, maybe we discount it because we see those things moving because of our little objects, but we don't see the movement of the pedestrian or the other car that may be coming at it, that thing is hiding, if that makes sense.
So as we discuss more about some driver safety tips, we will also be reviewing some of the other aspects of good health, such as emotional health, mental health, fatigue, and stress levels. But let's talk, since this is a original guide to men's health, a sensitive subject, about stats for men regarding crashes. And we won't call them accidents. And actually, why don't you state why words are so particular? There aren't really accidents, are there?
No. And this is it's sort of an innocent thing that has come out of history and tradition, that somehow, somewhere along the way, we got to calling things accidents. The problem with using accident as a word is that it tends to, by its very nature, it absolves blame and responsibility. So if you really stop to think about it, almost all accidents, what we think of as accidents, are preventable. So, and this, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a nuclear reactor, you know, having a meltdown, or somebody having a traffic crash. There's always a reason for it. And there's almost always a preventable reason. So I think when we think of accident, we think of, oh, it was just an accident, I didn't mean to do it. And we need to stop thinking of traffic crashes and incidences that way. In traffic safety parlance, we call them crashes, collisions, or incidents.
As we are a original guide to men's health, there are some statistics that show incidents or collisions involving men are actually higher in numbers than female drivers. A little of the background to that, if you can discuss that.
There is overwhelming evidence that males in general, Again, I'm just talking about generalizations here, that they tend to speed more, they drink more, they tend to not wear seatbelts as much, and they definitely are indulging in more risk-taking behavior than women. There are some physiological differences here. So, and it has to do with hormones and also with how men and women's brains develop. So the first thing is, you know, with hormones, there hasn't been a lot sort of paid attention to female hormones and actually to some degree with the male hormones. And so this is kind of a rapidly emerging sort of branch of science that's shedding more information by the year, I would say. So with males, you know, we all know that males tend to have a lot more testosterone than women. And that testosterone, I think it may be helpful to kind of preface this in terms of, you know, you have to think about how men and women evolved. So men were evolved, you know, in order to have competition for mates, to have as many children as possible, maybe to gain territory and to kind of have a certain status in their social groups. And so that kind of gave rise to, you know, aggression, much more assertive behavior, and feeling of competition for particular resources. And so that, you know, cars didn't come along until, you know, about 120 years ago. So we haven't had very much time evolutionarily to sort of develop kind of, you know, these evolutionary traits to a spirit of what life is like out on the road piloting vehicles, I would say. So anyway, we see this behavior in men, you know, tending to drive faster. You know, men enjoy the risk-taking because it sort of appeals to that desire to be competitive and to be aggressive and to also sort of be in control, actually. And then women, on the other hand, they have more estrogen than, of course, their male counterparts. And the thing with estrogen is that it helps them to literally to build empathy and a sense of cooperation, kind of a sense of social obligation. An abundance of estrogen is what helps women to take care of children, you know, support families, kind of lubricate those social connections. So in general, that is sort of the physiological evolutionary basis for what we're seeing out on the roads. So doesn't mean that there aren't aggressive women who are capable of bad behavior, and certainly doesn't mean that there aren't empathetic men who are very courteous and polite, but this is what drives a lot of those statistics.
You had some statistics about some of the Western states and some of the, I didn't realize, high incident statistics, and particularly Montana and Wyoming. I think speed limits are way up there, or at least acceptable speeds.
So Montana and Wyoming are interesting in that they have some of the highest fatality rates in the entire U.S., New Mexico as well. One of the reasons, as you mentioned, is the very high speed limits are about 80 miles an hour for daytime. And they don't really get reduced that much at nighttime either, which is another subject. Montana and Wyoming are interesting in that they are kind of sparsely populated states, so you can actually achieve those speeds. And they have long had a history in ranching, you know, very kind of male, very physical occupations like mining and ranching. The mining is not so much a thing anymore, so a lot of kind of middle class people there are struggling with the loss of jobs and kind of insecurities. And kind of going along with the sort of male-dominated physical occupation, there's kind of a very strong culture of sort of a Marlboro Man type machoism. So if you remember the Marlboro commercials, the cigarette commercials of the, you know, the cowboy and the sunset, and, you know, he's with his horse, or, you know, he has the cigarette there and he's very male, very masculine. And so interestingly, that continues to this day. And with the job insecurities and other things and the whole culture that goes along with that, men are very much under pressure to sort of keep up that stoic, masculine, I'll tough it out sort of mentality. And how that ends up playing out is that men in Montana and Wyoming in particular tend to have very, very high substance abuse, means alcohol and drugs, and not just illicit drugs, but prescription as well. And so that actually contributes to a lot of driver impairment issues, which means a lot more serious injuries and fatalities. That combined with the high speed limits, it just is a really lethal combination.
I was just actually chatting with a friend who's a psychiatrist yesterday, and he mentioned that benzodiazepines tend to peak within a half hour after ingestion, you know, so people aren't aware they take a pill, and they have to be aware of the side effects of the pill, particularly certain types of pill.
Right, exactly. Well, and interestingly, on that note, I attended a DUI enforcement conference in Oregon about a month and a half ago, and this is strictly for law enforcement who are learning to the symptoms, you know, when somebody's under impairment of certain drugs. And one thing that they talked about quite extensively is the availability, like even at gas stations, convenience stations, of certain kinds of food supplement products. They're marketed as supplements, but they actually contain uppers and downers in them that are not regulated by the FDA. So people are actively using these substances along with medications and drugs that may be illicit. So when you start to combine these things, they have an especially lethal effect, because some people actually take an upper and then they deliberately take something else to counteract as a downer. And then they go through the cycle again and again. And sometimes they are behind the wheel when this happens. If you start to think about that possibility, it means you really ought to be watching for behavior on the road. And to also, it doesn't excuse it, but maybe you can get a better understanding of why this is happening and how to watch out for it.
Well, let's explore age as far as driver safety. We can start with younger drivers. We know that insurance prorates younger drivers, costs more, and there's a reason for that. And then we can move to the aging driver. So go ahead and let's review age and driving.
So it probably won't surprise anybody listening that the most dangerous years for males tends to be when they're adolescents. So teenagers, usually new drivers. And that's true actually for new drivers of both genders. But it continues for males, especially in their 20s. And, you know, it's, if you start to think about it, there's brain development. Males' brains tend to mature at a later age than women. So now the male brain isn't fully formed, you know, in its adult form until they're in their mid or maybe even later 20s. Especially the area of the brain that is responsible for judgment. Those matters. A lot of hormone, of course, fluctuation when you're in the teenage years, whether you're male or female. So that is definitely at play. And there's, you know, because the brain isn't developed yet for the judgment area, but the brain is really well tuned for the risk taking and kind of thrill seeking opportunities. It's another reason why, you know, males, we see a lot of serious injuries and deaths with males when they're in their teens. The other interesting thing about this is that we see in general in traffic safety, we see a spike when males turn 19. And that is specifically because in more than 45 states in the US, there is actually no requirement for any kind of formal driver training once you turn the age of 18. You know, somehow that magical age of 18, you were okay. You didn't know anything the day before you turned 18. But once you're 18, you don't have to have formal training, as long as you can pass the written and the road test. So a lot of younger people are choosing to, you know, not go through the driver training because of expense or bother. And unfortunately, our driving test is so easy in this country that we don't necessarily need that training. If we can memorize, you know, and we have a little bit of practice, a tiny bit of practice behind the wheel. So unfortunately, that does turn out a lot more injuries and deaths at 19 and at 20. And then it tapers off when you're in your 20s. And then usually males and females, their rate of having crashes again, serious injuries and crashes and deaths, doesn't rise again until they're around in their mid to late 60s.
So a good segue into reviewing some bullet points for good driving habits and driver safety. If I come across one that I have a personal thought about, I'll throw in. But why don't you begin? Because you've done a lot of work in this and your expertise really lies in this. So let's mention for our listeners some of the wisdom that you can pass on regarding good driving habits.
Right. Okay, well, one of them is really obvious, actually, and we've heard about it for decades now, but it still is true, and that is to wear your seatbelt. In spite of all the advanced driver assistance technology we have in our cars and our great brakes and all of that, the seatbelt is actually, well, aside from the brakes, the seatbelt's probably the single most important piece of safety equipment there besides you and your brakes. And the reason is just simply because they are so effective that your chances of surviving a crash, even a very serious crash, you know, they go up something like 80 or 90% if you are wearing your seatbelt. And that is true for children, for pets, passengers, as well as drivers. And an interesting little dirty secret is that, you know, all the airbags that we have in our cars these days. Well, actually, an airbag will not function properly if you are not belted in. And the reason for that is the way that airbags are positioned by engineers, they are positioned to come out at to target a very specific part of your body if they are activated. So if you're not wearing your seatbelt, it means that you're going to slouch, slide under, sideways, and the airbag is going to miss its target that it's meant to protect you at, and you may get an injury from the airbag, or the airbag just simply may not be able to do its job. So always wear those belts. Another thing is, it's kind of an elephant in the room, but reducing distraction. So when I talk about distraction, there's all kinds of distraction, but specifically people can probably guess I'm talking about smartphone distraction. So talking on the phone, texting on the phone, checking your social media messages, responding to email. But obviously, you know, holding a device with your hand is really not good because you're limiting the control that you have with your hands with the steering wheel. On the other hand, hands-free and Bluetooth does not set you off the hook either, because it's actually the cognitive distraction that is more of an issue than the manual distraction, believe it or not. And there's been quite a few studies that have been done. In particular, Dr. David Strayer in the University of Utah has done some amazing work really breaking down this kind of distraction. And he and his team found out some years ago that even if you don't have the hands-free or the Bluetooth running, but let's just say that you were using your phone when you stopped at a traffic light, that it actually takes a while for your brain, once you finish that call or talking on the phone when you're stopped, to actually kind of get it all started again. Because there's a period of time where you're still transitioning from what you were saying or doing on the phone to the actual external environment around you. And so that impairment can actually last for as long as 27 seconds, you know, nearly a half a minute once you start moving again. So if you think about, you stopped at a light and the light turns green, you start to go, your brain may still be thinking about the thing you were just doing, not at the red light runner that's about to go through the intersection and hit you. So really important to keep those things in mind.
And as far as distractions, I will throw in my bias about people using the maps on smartphones or even in the car. I have seen more drivers cross three busy lanes without checking because their phone or the app actually in the console of the car told them that their off-ramp was coming up and they hadn't previewed it. And they didn't know enough about where they were going, which sometimes you just can't do if you're in a foreign city. But I would really urge everybody to preview where they're going and not just rely on the last second of the device, because you're going to make an unsafe maneuver. You have any thoughts about that?
Yes, I agree that, you know, one should generally preview. But again, as you say, it's not always a possible thing if you're in a foreign city, and sometimes the GPS can be wrong. So I think the first thing I would say is, yes, do try to preview, have some idea of what's going on, but don't stress out entirely if you can't memorize those directions, because that's just simply unrealistic. I would say the very first thing is you always have to do in any situation, whether you're using GPS or not, is pay attention to what is happening around you at that moment and always plan for the next few moments or as much as you can, in terms of really looking and concentrating on your environment. So first, do no harm, as they would say in medicine. A lot of people, we get conditioned to looking at screens, I would say. So we get in the habit of looking at screens and watching our GPS like it's a little TV. So a really good thing to do is to turn on the auditory part of it so you can be listening to the directions. I really love GPS. I couldn't live without it because it sure beats me trying to figure out where the heck I'm going looking down on a map. So I'm all for using GPS, but there's a right way to do it and a not so right way. So one of them is just training yourself to use the auditory feature. Don't watch it like a TV. If you look down at the screen, do it only for a second at the most. Never take your eyes off the road more than a second at a time. And that goes for any activity behind the wheel.
So you mentioned the United Kingdom as being superior as far as driver safety and road craft. Do you want to just go a little bit about what they do differently to keep people safe? And then we'll go back to some good driving habits. But they seem to instill good driving habits. How do they do it? What happens there?
Right. Well, first of all, just to kind of put this in context, so the UK ranks among the top developed nations in the world for comparable, infrastructure and so on, and economy. They rank always among the top five countries in the world for traffic fatalities for million miles traveled. The U.S. actually ranks at the very bottom, believe it or not, 19th or 20th out of that top 20. So that's just to give you some context. The U.K. has a huge traffic safety ecosystem that I think most Americans could never even comprehend. And I won't go into all of that, but one of the things that they've done is that starting in the 1940s and 50s, there was a real issue with police and emergency response teams getting into crashes and hitting pedestrians, especially when they were on their way to first responder calls. So, but this was happening at such a high rate that they realized they needed to do something pretty drastic. And so over the past 80 years, almost, they have refined a methodology that they call roadcraft, a wonderfully British term for special methodology that they devised that is really a framework for all best practice driving. So combines two acronyms. So there is IPSGA or IPSGA. So that stands for information. So that means communicating, taking information in from the road and also giving information back, like communicating to other drivers. So that's information. P is for position. So that literally means where you position your vehicle within the lane. And that's actually, a lot of people wonder about that, but there's actually a lot of wisdom to that. Speed, obviously, the speed at which you're entering the situation. Gear, because there they drive much more in manual than they do automatic. So that adds another layer of complexity. So you need to be in the proper gear for whatever situation you're in or you're about to enter. And then acceleration. And acceleration can also mean the lack of acceleration as well in order to control your position or whatever hazards you may be looking at. So that part is IPSGA. And then there's MSM, and that stands for mirror signal maneuver. So, and that's fairly self-explanatory. So between these two acronyms, it really forms an amazing framework. And the thing is that this methodology, the beauty of it is that it works in any vehicle, under any road condition, in any type of weather. I trained in the basics of roadcraft over three different sessions over a course of 5 years. And I'll tell you, it just completely changed my view of hazards car control, all that just overnight. And I thought I was a good driver before, that I was pretty aware of a lot of the hazards and observation issues. I came away with that even the first day of the behind the wheel training thinking, oh my gosh, how did I not hit something, you know, how did I not hit more things in my past 26 years of driving? So learning that really informs my way of looking at the road and traffic safety in kind of a unique way. And I really encourage people to look into it more. Again, it's sort of a more advanced form. It's meant for police drivers specifically. But the thing is that there are principles of roadcraft that have filtered down to every new learner driver being trained in the UK today.
So let's look at positioning. You know, one of my pet peeves is people who sit in a blind spot for another driver. You know, I like move up, move back, but don't stay there because that person, even with the electronics that are now available in cars, is a dangerous place to be. So go a little bit about positioning.
Right. So you're absolutely right. You should never hang in somebody's blind spot. You know, I think maybe we know this more about big trucks because we tend to see a little bit more on that, but just a regular vehicle. And because of all the vision issues that I just talked about, now you know some of the problems with that. So I always make it a point to not, if I can, I don't try to hang out next to another driver. It's almost like social distancing on the road, you know, not to bring up the pandemic equivalent, but I'm positively antisocial on the road, just meaning that I always want to have a bubble of space around me. I try to be ahead or behind a vehicle, not in their blind spot. And I also try not to be abreast because it's just too easy for somebody next to me to drift. Or I might need that space as well if I come across something. So it's just a really good practice to not be abreast. And especially you might try to pay attention to if there's more than one of you, more than two of you, a situation where vehicles are three abreast is particularly dangerous because you've just compounded all those things. And the one thing I didn't get to mention in vision is that a very interesting phenomenon is that if something is traveling at the same speed, at the same angle, at the same distance relative to you, you might not actually see it. It may appear stationary to you. And this is why when we're in, say, in the furthest right lane on a freeway and somebody's merging a car or even a big truck, you might not actually see them coming up alongside you until they're practically on top of you. And that is because of this very weird optical illusion we get where something looks stationary and it's not. So getting back to the driving alongside someone, that can also happen as well in that situation.
And, you know, we all talk about distances and ability to react and brake. But, you know, some people feel if they leave too much space, somebody else will just move into it, right?
So yes, that's very, very common. And I hate to say it, you almost always hear that from males rather than females, but I'm just saying it's true. Yeah, that's a really interesting phenomenon. So yes, many people have said, well, I don't want to lose that space. That space belongs to me. Somebody might get ahead of me. Or I just might lose that space. So my comment to that is that, first of all, for following distances, you should always leave 3 seconds. So we're not talking car lengths. We're talking about 3 time seconds of distance between you and the vehicle ahead of you on dry pavement. Should be 6 seconds if it's wet, rainy. And then if for anything that's icy or snowy, it should be at least a minimum of 9 seconds and sometimes as much as 12. So I won't go into how to measure that. People can look that up and how to figure that out. But that's actually quite a bit of distance. Now, remember that if you're going at a very slow speed, like stop and go or 20 miles an hour in a traffic jam, it's not as much distance as you might think because we're talking about time, not car length distance. So my answer is, well, what if somebody does get in front of you? Well, the thing is that space in front of you is the only insurance that you have, really, right? Because you're just managing time management and distance. So if somebody wants to get ahead of you, that's just fine, because it's probably better than having them tailgate behind you or getting more and more upset because somebody's not letting them in. So that's why you're keeping that space in front of you, is to keep the spacing for all the cars on the road porous enough that it accommodates people on the road. And there's been some really interesting traffic studies done, in fact, that show that if you keep this kind of porousness and you simply back off, you slow down, you regain that space, it means that fewer cars have to brake, which means then you can actually single-handedly prevent a traffic jam, believe it or not, by keeping that kind of space. So it's called traffic waves, if anybody wants to look that up.
And, you know, that notion of that space ahead belongs to me, and road rage sort of go hand in hand. You know, if somebody really wants to get past you, move over, let them go. And I just remember our car talk guys, you know, just comment about, you know, somebody who is really just busting the road said, yeah, they might get there a few seconds sooner. The speeding doesn't really translate into that much saving of time, but you can't convince somebody. So, you know, drive workers, move over, let them go, and don't get into it.
Right. Well, and I think that has even more implication, because as we all are highly aware of right now, you know, a lot of people do carry weapons. A lot of people are under the influence of things. And so that's the thing, is you never, ever know what could happen. And there have been plenty of cases where, you know, people who are experiencing road rage, the perpetrators of road rage, they're shooting guns out of their cars, and sometimes deliberately or sometimes at random. So unfortunately, in the society we live in, it is always the better thing to not provoke, not instigate, not have eye contact even, just totally ignore that person and just do your best to get out of their way.
So, you know, the idea of having some road awareness of what's ahead of you, you know, you don't want to drive too far ahead of yourself, but it is good to look down the road a bit. Where should you be focusing, and some tips about what you should be looking at, you know, as far as evolving situations and how far ahead you should be looking?
Well, that's a really good question. The short answer is you should be looking as far ahead as you possibly can. You know, a lot of people kind of drive right in the moment and right according to the vehicle right directly in front of them. The number one thing about driving, whether you're on a racetrack or a rally car or in a regular vehicle or a truck, a big truck, is always be looking up. Most drivers tend to look down. It's kind of subconscious. We're sort of trained that way. We don't realize it. So look up, 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 whether it's 3 miles ahead that you can see, you know, on the horizon point at the distance, quarter mile ahead. If you can only see 100 feet ahead of you because of fog, point is you always need to be looking up as far as you possibly can. And then the second thing would be to alternate how you're looking. So of course you're going to be looking up far ahead, but you also need to bring your vision back to what is happening more immediately in front of you. So more immediately in front of you could be the vehicle ahead, but much better would be to be looking at, if possible, what's happening 3 vehicles ahead of you or more. It all depends on the context, obviously, where you're driving and how things are spaced. But the point is you can never look too far ahead. But you also need to not be looking so far ahead that you ignore the dangers that are closer to you as well.
Pilots have a concept of scanning. They're scanning their instruments, they're scanning the outside, they're scanning awareness. And you know, I think it was always taught to us when we were in driver's training to scan, look ahead, be aware of what's evolving ahead, but also scan your mirrors left and right and rear. Be aware situationally of what's going on 360 around you as a driver.
Exactly, right. And this is something that in the UK, where I just talked about how driving standards are so strict, they will fail you on the test if you are not looking every 4 to 8 seconds at your mirror, not just your rearview mirror, but all your mirrors. And we're not really taught in the U.S. to look at our mirrors very often. It is mentioned, of course, that it is taught, but not to the extent that it is in the U.K. And the value of looking in your mirrors as often as you possibly can is that it increases your situational awareness, meaning that you are aware of what's going on, not just in front of you, but behind you, on your corners, and so on. And so you might think of it this way. You might wonder, well, when do I look at my mirrors? You know, because 4 to 8 seconds is a lot. Think of in the UK, they are taught to look in their mirrors before every intersection, before they brake, before they accelerate. Basically, they're taught to look in the mirrors before they enter any situation in which they might influence the outcome for themselves and others. So that's a good guideline. And that means a lot of looking in mirrors. But again, you can almost never be looking too much at your mirrors, because after all, it can make the difference between you have an escape route that you already know about that you can react to in a way. Let's say there's an object in front of you, or somebody suddenly starts to swerve because you've been looking in those mirrors and you know what's around you and you know where those empty spaces are. It means that you can act quicker.
And that leads right into my other bias, which is seems like signaling is a forgotten art. And, you know, signals are there to use to, you know, let other people know your intention. And so many people change lanes or move or do something without any warning.
Right. Well, and it comes in all forms. So, you know, some people don't signal at all. My personal favorite is the signaling while you're doing it, not before, but while you're doing it, almost as an afterthought, which I think a lot of us have done, actually, myself included, especially if traffic is very tight. But yeah, that part does happen. A guideline is, again, driving is a lot about planning and observation. So planning ahead. I know sometimes if you have to make a very quick turn, it can be very hard, but really, really try to. This is a guideline. First of all, turn on your signal before you start to move, not as you're doing it. And then challenge yourself to see if you can have the signal click 4 times before you actually do the move. And the reason for that is it gives other people a chance to see that your signal is on. Again, many people are distracted. So we know that people are not always seeing the things that are happening in real time. So that's a good thing to work on the next time you get in your car.
And just sort of going along with that, monitoring road conditions, the things aren't always static. So you don't continue driving as before if road conditions change. Maybe the condition of the road or the conditions that the weather is bringing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think a good rule of thumb is to always expect the unexpected. Always think that anything could happen at any time, because that really is true. Even if it's just your commute from home to work, the road is always changing. And I cannot tell you how quickly things can change. You know, one moment everything seems fine. It was just the way that it always has been. It's quiet. And then the next thing you know, there's 3 things happening at once. And how could you have ever predicted it? Nobody can. But that's why that situation awareness, being aware of your vision, what's around you, you know, those things all will help to kind of give you a mental lubrication so that when the unexpected does happen, you are just that much more prepared for it.
As we get close to wrapping up, I just want to touch on 2 topics. One is autonomous vehicles. We hear a lot about it. In fact, a neighbor just talked about the fact his son, who's working on getting his license, said, well, why do I need to bother? I'll be in an autonomous vehicle soon. So, you know, it's a good point, but talk about that. Where are we with autonomous vehicle driving?
Yeah, well, as you might imagine, I've been following this ever since the beginning, and I'm actually on a government work group here in Washington State that actually we are part of a work group that advises and strategizes about autonomous vehicle testing and use within the state. So I'm very aware of many of these things. As much as Elon Musk and lots of other people in the media and automakers say, oh, we're going to have autonomous driving, self-driving cars here within next year or a few years, it is just simply not true. It's not true in the sense that we private citizens will have our access to our own autonomous vehicle. That is not actually going to come in at least 20 or maybe even 30 years, or maybe not even ever. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Where we will see autonomous vehicles, and we are starting to now, actually, is actually public transport and shuttle or private shuttle vehicles that are geofenced. We are seeing that now in agricultural applications like tractors and combines, and especially with freight. So shortage of truck drivers in this country, especially severe. So there's a lot of work being done with autonomous semi-tractor trailers hauling cargo across the country. So, but as far as our being able to own an autonomous vehicle, no, that's not going to happen for us. But on the other hand, will our vehicles have to pilot around an autonomous vehicle that's owned by a shuttle company? Yes, that is true. But a lot of that sort of thing is going to be regulated and geofenced, meaning that these aren't going to be vehicles that are just generally running around and roads in a way that we would have to regularly interact with. However, that said, the thing is that we have all these building blocks for autonomous vehicles, and that comes in the form of advanced driver assistance systems. It's collectively called ADAS. So things like variable cruise control, automatic emergency braking, lane keeping, those are things that are on our cars today. All new cars coming out today have some form of that, and that will only be increasing. Some of them, the automakers say, well, especially I would say Tesla is the worst culprit in this. They claim that it's self-driving, that it's autopilot, that's their market name for it. Extremely misleading, because there is absolutely no vehicle on the road today that even begins to approach true self-driving cars, no matter what the claims are or what their capabilities. Yes, they can see things on the road, they can steer themselves, they can brake themselves, accelerate themselves, but nobody should ever confuse that with true self-driving. And that means that they need to be paying attention at all times.
And then I really enjoyed being able to attend a car control clinic. Most car clubs offer them. And why don't you go into whether a new driver, or not necessarily a young driver, but a new driver should go to a novice track event such as a car control clinic? There's pros and cons. You want to address that a little bit?
Yeah. As much as I'm in traffic safety and all about safety, I actually really love cars. So I, you know, have indulged, and I've had Audis and BMWs. And so I've had the honor and the privilege of being able to attend a lot of high performance driving events that are put on by local car clubs like the BMW and the Audi Porsche clubs, you know, other places. And this is a really interesting area, because it's kind of actually one of the very few places where people can, and just regular people like you and I, we can go and we can take our vehicle, and they don't even have to be high performance vehicles. There's many clinics where you can just go out on the track, actually, and you can do it at speed, and you do it with instructors who instruct you every mile of the way, so to speak. It's a fantastic experience. I highly recommend it for anyone who has an interest and really wants to know what their car can do. It's a whole lot of fun. It's also useful to know about the physics of your car. So, you know, and to also sort of know the limits of your car. Steering, definitely it's worth knowing emergency braking, other things like that. It's just good to know what your car can do and what it cannot do, and more likely what your limits are, because chances are your limits are a lot more limiting than what your car can do, actually. That's a whole other subject. But one of the problems is that sometimes these clinics are marketed saying that the principles that you will learn in these clinics, how your car feels, the controls, are a panacea for good street driving. And I would say that that's somewhat misleading. The original purpose for these car clinics, even the teen clinics, is that people wanted to get their high performance vehicles out on a racetrack like situation, but people didn't know the first thing about what car control actually is. And so people were crashing left and right. And so they needed to, you know, kind of stem this a bit. And so they started having these clinics where instructors would go and they would teach people. They would put them through exercises like breaking and slalom and skid pad and stuff, all in the name of just, you know, being able to know what your vehicle can do so that you don't get out on the track and kill yourself, you know. But the problem is that in order to get more people to sign up, they also started to believe to some degree the instructors that, and I'm not putting blame on the instructors or the car clubs, it's just sort of a natural outgrowth, that this would be also things that you could apply to public roads. But the reality is that that isn't always true. And the worst thing about it is that it can give people a sense of false confidence. And this was very much demonstrated in Norway and Sweden, because Norway and Sweden, they have very icy, snowy, slippery climates. And so for a while, Norway, they actually required skid pad and snowy condition training as part of their driver training for all new drivers. Well, they found that once they started doing that, their rates of fatalities and serious injuries went up significantly. And they realized it was because the people who were learning this for the first time, they may do well in an instructed environment and in a controlled environment like you would with driver training, but not so much when you get out into the more unpredictable real world, partly because it's impossible to learn a skill, an emergency skill like this, without practicing it consistently the correct way a lot. And so once you're not in driver training, you don't do this anymore. So the short of it is that it led to overconfidence. People thought they knew what they were doing and they really didn't. So that's the exact same danger that people can be prone to in these high performance clinics, even some of the teen clinics. So I think it's important for people to know that. So I'm not saying no, you should by all means attend it because it's fun. If your intent is to drive on the track, by all means, absolutely do it. But don't always consider that what they teach you is a thing that you should always be taking to public roads.
Well, I think given time, we could go on with another session, and maybe we will, but I'm just going to mention some philosophy that a friend had passed on to his young drivers, and it was obviously don't drive with alcohol. But he didn't stop there. He told them, if your friends are impaired and getting in a car and something happens, I'm going to hold you responsible. Meaning, don't let your friends or people that you witness get in a car and drive and take responsibility, even if you're not going to be the driver. He told them, as far as friends went, they could spend the night, no questions asked, just tell the parents they decided to spend the night, but don't let them get in a car and feel the necessity they have to drive.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the more important things that we can do, whether we're drivers or not, but especially as passengers. If you see anybody getting behind a wheel that really shouldn't, it's your responsibility. A lot of times we think, you know, we're a little afraid, you know, we don't want to offend somebody. We're worried about what other people would think of us. Maybe we're the party pooper if we don't get in that car with that person. You think it's going to be okay. But sadly, especially among younger drivers, teens, that is not the case. And there are many, many tragic injuries and deaths as a result. So always have that courage to intervene and do not get into a vehicle with someone who is not fit to be behind the wheel. Tell your friends not to do that either and offer support. You know, tell that driver, look, I'll drive, we'll arrange for different transportation. Find a way to take those keys away, whatever you need to do. If more of us did that, I actually think we could make a dent in traffic crashes, and we could also make a dent in distracted driving. So for instance, a smartphone, you call somebody or somebody answers and you can tell that they're behind the wheel. Just say, I'll call you back later when you're safely stopped and pulled over.
Well, it has been a wonderful episode. I have a slew of references that you supplied that are too numerous to list, but we will put them and post them on the website under this episode at the Original Guide to Men's Health. On the website for this episode, we'll find these, but your own is at drivinginthereelworld.com. And we have the site for the Fighter Pilot's Guide to Surviving on the Roads by John Sullivan that you mentioned. But we go on, and there are numerous great ones here that I would implore people to take a look at and find something of interest that will certainly make everyone a better driver, a safer driver. And we can have those posted. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us and educating us about how to become safer and better drivers, something that we all can benefit from.
Yes, well, thank you so much here. It was such an honor being on your show, and I really hope that your listeners got a lot out of this and be safe.
This completes another episode of the original Guide to Men's Health podcast. We wish to thank all guests who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The show's recordings are engineered and edited by Sean Fox. Episode titles and descriptions, as well as editing assistance, are provided by Dr. Kathleen O'Connor, PhD. Music for our show is San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. David Weidig. The podcast is sponsored and published by the Washington State Urology Society. The original Guide to Men's Health is an original publication of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the expressed or written consent of the Society is prohibited. For more information about men's health and previous episodes, as well as additional recommended resources, visit us online at theoriginalguidetomenshealth.com. This is Dr. Richard Pellman thanking you for listening and reminding you to take care of yourself.